So I would like to give the floor, as I think we say in English, to Professor David Shulman, who is in Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And I could go on describing who he is, but better you hear, better you listen to him.
Thank you very much. Let me begin by adding my thanks to the organizers for the privilege of being here for these two very rich days. I'm going to offer just a few reflections from a South Indian vantage point about textuality, more specifically about what I'll call scripturalization. This is following Shelley Pollack's use of the word, also the German Latinist Leon Haut, whom some of you may know. So scripturalization, that is to say, what happens when we have a culture that allows the recording of texts? It's a cultural event in writing. But I'll be asking myself what kinds of writing we're dealing with. And if there's time at the end, I'll say a few words about canonization as well. But I'll be speaking about works in Telugu, Malayalam, Sanskrit, and Tamil, and from a very kind of bottom-up perspective, that is to say, a grassroots perspective, what these texts look like in practice, and I'm talking about literary texts and also performance texts, or literary texts as they are performed. I have three examples. I'll try to run through them in a very concise way. You should keep in the back of your mind three basic questions, namely, what is the text? What is the text that we're referring to, and how do we know it as such? Secondly, how was it inscribed or recorded? And thirdly, is there anything we can say about the afterlife of the text once it has already been inscribed? So I'm going to begin with a relatively simple example from Telugu. And here, the question that I want to ask is what happens, I'll begin really with the end of this question, what happens when a text is reduced to writing in such a way that we have a kind of dependence or primacy to the written text? And I'm thinking actually not so much about the inscription in manuscripts, palm leaf or whatever it may be, but I'm thinking primarily, one might say, about the transition into the print culture when we began publishing these great kavya works in the 19th century. Really, the question is what is lost or flattened in the transition to a written and especially to a printed text. So the example comes from a Telugu text called the Vasucharitramu. It's a 16th century Telugu Prabandha or Kavya, Mahakavya, by a poet called Bhattumurti. It's written in the middle of the 16th century. It's a very difficult work, possibly the most difficult book to read in Telugu. It has about 1,500 verses, every one of them extraordinarily complex. About 90% of them are shlishta, that is to say, they are bi-textual, as Yigal Broner would say. They have to be deciphered painfully, as if you were deciphering a kind of puzzle. We have actually pretty good editions of this text. We have manuscripts that are not very old, but there's manuscript evidence. We have the verses, the verbal text, but what is it that we don't have? So here's an interesting case. The Vasucharitramu actually, it's a text of many themes, but one of the dominant themes has to do with music, with the expressive and pragmatic and transformative powers of music. So it's really a book, one might say, about classical South Indian music. And this is a rare case where we actually know that each one of these 1,500 some verses was sung in a very particular raga. That is, there was a raga for every single verse. That's very unusual in South India. Normally, in South Indian classical texts, in all the languages, the performer has a certain leeway. Unlike the performance of Sanskrit vritta meters, which usually follow a very set pattern, melodic pattern, perhaps regionally inflected, Unlike that in South India, normally a performer can choose which raga he wants to perform, depending on how he's feeling, how the audience may be communicating to him, all kinds of things relating to the time of day or the time of night, the time of year, and all kinds of things. He has a certain leeway, but not here. Not accidentally. This is a text where every single verse had a specific raga. But you know what? This information has been lost. We actually know the name of the last person. He was a pundit from the Godavari Delta. He lived in the early part of the 19th century. He was the last man who had this knowledge. That knowledge has been lost. So you should bear in mind that when we look at a printed version of a text like the Vasucharitramu, well, this particular text, so we have lost one of the primary intrinsic dimensions of the actual existence of this text in performance. And that's not the only thing that's been lost. They're what I would call paratextual features. So there's a long list of these, but let me just say that that means things that have to do with metrical and rhythmic effects, all kinds of syntactical elements that come into play in the course of a performance, particular emphases and repetitions. And above all, this is something which is peculiar to Telugu. I believe it exists only in Telugu. At least as a dominant feature of the text, the disjunction that always exists in a classical Telugu verse between the, let's call it the normal linguistic verbal syntax and the metrical or rhythmic parsing. There's a kind of contrapuntal effect. Actually, this is close to something that Shelley's written about in his first book on Sanskrit meter. It's a diagnostic feature of Telugu poetry that as you hear the verse recited, you hear this counterpoint, that is the actual semantic level of the text in its syntactical form and the musical or rhythmic effect which runs somehow counter to that. That gives a particular kind of charm, almost a bewitching effect to Telugu poetry. That can be perhaps painfully reconstructed to some extent if you're reading a text like this on the printed page. But it's not like listening to it. And along with that, there are other things you see listed, metapoetic reflections that are somehow imbued in that paratextual dimension. I'm not going to say more about that, but I do want to say that there's another thing which has been lost, and that is the oral commentary, the Vyakhyana. So what do I mean by that? It's impossible to recite a verse of this particular text, the Vasucharitramu, without commenting upon it. It has no meaning whatsoever. No Telugu pundit, however skilled, would be able to hear such a verse and immediately understand it. It takes time. I can tell you from experience, it can take anywhere between 10 minutes and an hour to figure out what the actual verbal content of the text actually is, you know. So you need a particular richness of commentary. And although we have, of course, traces of these very early performance commentaries that were woven into the actual recitation of the verse, believe me, they are a pale reflection to the richness of the commentary that was there in oral performance and is still sometimes there in oral performance. I'm afraid that that's been flattened, not entirely lost, but flattened. Another way to say this is to say that this particular text, the Vasucharitramu, I think it's the pinnacle of Telugu poetry, this text exists with an amazing tension built into it, especially as performed in an oral mode, a tension between what you could call the hyper-semantic verbal text which is so saturated with meanings, often multiple meanings, that it takes a lot of time just to disentangle the semantic form, tension between the hyper-semantic verbal text and the hyposemantic musical rhythmic text, which may actually be predominant in terms of meaning. So where does the meaning of a text like the Vasucharitramu lies? It lies somewhere in that relationship, okay? Okay, now I'm going to go on to a topic which has become a kind of obsession with me. I'm going to be talking for a few minutes about Kudiyattam. So we're moving south into Kerala. Kudiyattam, there are many people in this room who know Kudiyattam well. Virginie Johan is here. She's made a pioneering contribution to our understanding of the text. Where are you, Virginie? I don't see you. Did you go away? There you are. Yeah, okay. For the last 9 years, we've had groups of students from Jerusalem and from the University of Tübingen going to see full-scale performances of Kuriatem in Kerala. Full-scale performances, this is, first of all, let me say, this is the last surviving relic of classical Sanskrit drama in live performance. It's the last. So this is Sanskrit theater, and we have the texts of the plays. The texts are, with one exception, one major exception, they're all texts that were composed in Sanskrit in Kerala in the medieval period. The one exception is the first and second acts of the Nagananda of Harshadeva. Those of you who know the text know that it's actually a Kerala play. It's all about Kerala. Perhaps that explains why it alone from the classical repertoire was performed there, is still performed. So these are Sanskrit texts. They're composed in very long performances. The shortest is 12 hours, and it goes up to 150 hours or something like that, spread over various days and nights. So it could be 15 nights or 29 nights or 44 nights. There's even a recorded memory of a 61-night performance. These are long performances by our standards. Actually, I don't think they're so long, but anyway, everybody else thinks they're long. And the unit of performance, this is very important, is the individual act. No one ever in Kuriatem performs an act in a kind of linear sequence from the beginning via the middle to the end. That never happens. The text is there. It's fixed and unchanging, more or less unchanging, the Sanskrit text, but it's been completely jumbled and rearranged. And although I can't go into the details of this, let me just say that one major structural unit is this retrospective, what is called the Nirvahanam, in which a particular character, that is a single actor on stage, goes often for many nights. It could be 4 or 5 or 10 or 12 nights or more than that. In this retrospective, all kinds of things turn up. His memories, his or her memories, his or her fantasies and wishes, odd pieces of knowledge about this and that, mythological or other traditional knowledge, all kinds of associative episodes and so on. These are not improvised, I'll explain in just a moment, but you can see that there's an enormous expansion of the actual Sanskrit text, the mula. So I have something to say about that. And let me just say that this expansion is recorded. In fact, it's doubly recorded. Sorry, just one moment. It's recorded in handwritten notebooks in Malayalam that have been passed down through the families of the actors, the Chakyar actors over the various generations. They're called Akta Prakaram. They're performance manuals. And they tell you very precisely, in quite a lot of detail, what is going to happen at any given night. So incidentally, that shows you that the division into units of single nights or single days is quite old. It goes back at least to sometime in the early 16th century and possibly much earlier than that. So these Atta Prakaram texts, they include the expansions that I just mentioned that are called Vistara. Expansion is only one form of meddling with the text. You also have forms of compression and what I would call suppletion when other texts are brought in place of something that we actually have. And so, I mean, there's a whole series of these possible semantic operations. But if we ask ourselves, what is the text that we are dealing with? What is the text? If we go to see Act One of Nagananda, as we have, so what is the text that we are seeing? So I can tell you what we are not seeing is the text of the Sanskrit play in any way that would be familiar to the original classical tradition. Nothing like that. It's there, the text of the play, buried in the midst of this vast world of expansion. The text that you're seeing is, in effect, a kind of externalization of the Atta Prakaram. You're seeing a performance that is based upon the Atta Prakaram very precisely in most cases, although it's not exactly coterminous with the Atta Prakaram, and there is leeway for change. I'll say something more about that in just a moment. How is this performance text recorded. So I said a moment ago, it's been recorded twice. On the one hand, we have the Atta Prakaram handbooks. But the more consequential recording, inscription, you might say, takes place on the level of abhinaya, that is to say, the gestures of hands, and particularly eyes in Kudiyattam, which inscribe the text in empty space. I'd be prepared to argue that in South India, abhinaya inscription is perhaps the most privileged and important way of inscribing a text. This is not to say that palm leaves and copper plates and stone inscriptions are unimportant. They're obviously very important. But they're not as powerful as the abhinaya inscription. That is one way to write a text, a privileged, preferred way. Now, I have to say, so I've answered actually two of the questions that I posed at the beginning. What is the text? It is the text of the Atta Prakaram in some kind of externalization, which might change from troupe to troupe, possibly from performance to performance, but it's pretty much fixed. And how is it fixed? How has it been inscribed? How has it been scripturalized, one might say, in abhinaya? What about the question of how this text grows? What is the afterlife of the text? So here there's an interesting thing. We're going to have to allow for the possibility that there are different differential intensities of fixation within the abhinita natakam, that is to say, within the inscribed text as we find it in the abhinaya. What do I mean by that? So there's, of course, a very great level of fixity in the Sanskrit text of the original, which is buried in the performance text. Even there, the actors actually can play with it a little bit in the sense that they can do interesting repetitions. I mean, there's a whole semiotics of the way the verses are recited and how they have to be expanded and in what context and so on. Virginie has written beautifully about that. That is fixed, though, in the sense that that text doesn't change at all. But actually, most of the abhinaya text, as we see it on the stage, is also pretty much fixed. That is, it has to, that logic is there. At least you could say that the structural elements have to follow the abhinaya. Well, they don't exactly have to, but they usually do. And in some cases, we know for sure that they have a certain kind of, one might even say, a moral impetus to following the Atta Prakaram manual very closely. How do we know this? For example, we have a text called the Anguliyangam. That's the sixth act of a Sanskrit play, the Ashtaraya Chudamani by Shakti Bhadra. That's a text in which Hanuman brings Rama's ring to Sita, so the Anguliyangam. Yeah. The Anguliyangam takes 29 nights to perform. You can imagine the richness of the, let's call it the expansion, the Vistara. This expansion has a particular structure. The tradition is that if the actor, who's usually a single actor on stage, if he makes a mistake, then somebody, even a trivial mistake, a tiny mistake, the wrong gesture, let alone the wrong pronunciation of a single syllable in Sanskrit, if he makes a mistake, somebody in his family will die. So you can see that there's a level of fixation which is very impressive. Again, I want to say that fixation comes to expression, fullest expression, in the abhinaya. I said to the main actor, Margi Madhu, when we were about two-thirds of the way through this 29-night performance, I said to him at one point, you know, it's wonderful, everything's great, the only problem is that it's too short. And actually, I meant it because I think that Kudiyattam is a rather fast-moving art form, and a lot happens in any given moment. But Madhu laughed, a little embarrassed, because for him it's not too short. These actors are carrying an enormous burden of remembering many hundreds, it could even be thousands, of Sanskrit verses that have to be recited precisely, and all of the gestures that go with it. But you can imagine what it is like to have the threat of making a mistake hanging over your head for 29 nights. And indeed, when it was over, you could actually visibly see the relief. But that's an indication that the text has been written down, inscribed, as I said before, in space, in the very conservative medium of the abhinaya. Nonetheless, it is possible for the actors to make all kinds of interesting additions. So I don't want to go into this at any great length, but we've seen this many times. For example, last summer, We saw what's called the Parnashalankam, that's act one of this same play of Shakti Bhadra's. Parnashalankam, which is the prelude to the appearance of the demoness Shurpanakha in the wilderness. You know, in the course of the performance, the early nights of the Nirvahanam retrospection, various things happened. There were sort of relatively minor changes, but once they were on stage, you can be sure that they were then somehow perpetuated and fixed in the Abhinaya mode. So, for example, there's a verse, I've given it to you here, we're not going to have time to read it, but there's a verse from Maga, this Shikrim Saya Kritima Patri Pankte, which was inserted into the description of the city of Ayodhya. You can read the verse at your leisure, those of you who like Magha. And we'll come to this other example in just 1 second. Am I doing on time? Another 10 minutes? 10 minutes, that's fine. Okay. I want to say one or two other things with reference to this question of the text and what it is and how the recording in Abhinaya actually works. So I've just allowed for the possibility of textual expansion and improvisation, which again I want to say tends to become fixed. There was another interesting case in these early nights of the Parnashalankam in which, Thomas Gray has a famous English poem, the elegy written in a country churchyard. There's a Malayalam translation of this poem from the early 20th century, which everybody knows. And actually, believe it or not, Thomas Gray's Malayalam version of this poem found its way into the Parnashalankam, and it is probably there, at least in the form that the drama takes in this particular troupe, forever. So there is an element of what you could call organic growth at the initiative of the actor, and this growth then can take various forms, but it does eventually tend to be fixed. There's another two elements that I want to say. I want to come back for a second to the question of the relation between the Sanskrit mula, that is the original text of the Sanskrit play, and what we actually see on stage. So this is actually a very complicated question. I can't give you a model for it at this point, although I do want to say that Lin Bansaboudon produced a very sophisticated model, do you remember, in the Kilimangalam, of the relations between these two texts. It'll perhaps be enough here if I simply say that the relations between the Sanskrit original text, the Sanskrit mula, and its actualization on stage seem to me to be relations of mutual interdependence, mutual conditioning. It's not the case, in my view, that we have an original text which then is expanded and grows and commented upon as we're used to thinking about so many texts, including the main texts of the classical tradition in the West. I don't think that's the case. You have to allow for a model in which the Akta Prakaram world has somehow been present even before the fixation of the original Sanskrit text. At least that's what I would be prepared to argue. I could say more about that later. Finally, there's another thing which is really critical here, and I'm just going to mention it en passant. That is the fact that along with the expansions that go into various textual modes and bring in all kinds of different materials, you have what I would want to call a latent intertext, sometimes many latent intertexts. So these are texts that will not appear on stage. And yet, if you follow the logic of the performance and you speak to the actors, and maybe if you're a little lucky, that's what happened to us last summer, because by a sheer stroke of luck, we discovered one of the primary intertexts for this particular performance of the Parnashalankam, is the text never performed on the stage, comes from a work called the Ramayana Prabandham, which is a Sanskrit Ramayana from Kerala. Here it is. Remember I said to you that this describes what happens before Shurpanakha arrives. So there is the moment in the Ramayana Prabandham when Shurpanakha turns up and she has a complaint. She says, I'll just read it in English. You have the Sanskrit, those of you who want it, kind of Kerala Malayali Sanskrit. She says, why did the creator, the source of our own family, not make me like her, that is Sita, like her? The wife of that man who is an ocean of beauty. She's in love with Rama. Right? But let that be. Why did he waste her charms like moonlight in a wilderness on that heartless man who is happy living in this forest? And that phrase, kanana chandrika samadasham, moonlight in a forest that nobody can see. That turns out to be, once you get to know the play, a kind of deep thematic textual element which is present throughout. So these latent intertexts, which I would argue are there in every single Kuryatin performance, if you ask me, they're the key to one of the levels of meaning. If you want to understand what the play means, you have to find these hidden intertexts. So you can see that we're beginning to achieve a kind of level of complexity. And I also should mention the fact that the Abhinaya, among other things, shows you sound, gives us sound in a visible form. Sound in Kuryatam should be visible. That's a widespread principle of medieval India, of course, tantric, not only tantric. We're talking about visible sound, and I'm going to give you one final example, and then I'll stop. I'll have to just quickly say a few words about this. So there's something called the Adhyayanotsavam. The Adhyayanotsavam, that is the festival of recitation, let's call it. This is something that happens at three Sri Vaishnava temples in the Tamil country, at Sri Vidiputur, at Arvar Tirunagari, and at Sri Rangam. It's an annual event, usually a 10-day recitation. It's a recitation performance of the Tiruvaimori. The Tiruvaimori is the central canonical text of the South Indian Tamil Sri Vaishnavas by Nammarvar. So this text, the entirety of the Tiruvaimori, it's a long text, 1,000 verses. It's performed over these 10 days and nights. It's performed by the Arayar. They're a particular group of people who live in these temples and perform in the temples, so it's a ritual performance. It's performed in what they say reflects the division of Tamil itself, the Tamil language, into three categories. That's a very old thing in Tamil. So in Tamil, we have what is called Isai Tamil, that is to say musical Tamil. Tamil is somehow identified with music. In the case of the Tiruvaimori, it's not hard to find that dimension because, of course, the verses are sung. But then there is what is called Nadagam, that is the dramatic Tamil of performance. The Nadagam in this case is Abhinaya Rupa. You see, the Tiruvaimori, like the Kuryatam, comes complete with a set of Abhinaya performance gestures, which are highly regulated. And again, I want to say, here we have another example, not the only example. Those are some of you perhaps having Vedic associations. It's another example of the fixation of a text in space, in the gestures of open space. This is a particularly interesting example for many reasons. And then there's also what's called Il Tamil, that is to say natural Tamil. By Il Tamil, what they mean is Vyakhyanam. They mean commentary, the commentary that is impregnated into the text, interwoven into the text, indistinguishable in some ways from the actual text, you know. These three elements are absolutely necessary for the Adhyayanotsavam to take place. So here we've gone beyond just the notion of inscription, although again, you have that inscription in Abhinaya. We've gone beyond that, and we're now talking about a kind of canonization, because the Nammarvar text was canonized in a two-stage process according to the tradition. First, there was somebody called Madhurakavi who was taught the poems by the poet himself. And then, after he had instituted this way of ritual performance of a 10-night festival every year in the Sri Rangam temple, after he had done this, Madhurakavi, that tradition was forgotten and had to be reconstructed or reimagined by somebody called Natamuni, who was not a poet but an Ashcharya. He is the source of the Adhyayanotsavam as we have it today. It takes place in the presence of Madhurakavi himself in the form of a metal icon, and also the poet Nammarvar is there. And Nammarvar, I don't have time to explain it to you, but Nammarvar himself goes through a whole series of rather important changes and transformations in the course of the recitation, ending up with his achieving moksha. This turns out to be a periodic event that has to happen every year. Once a year, Nammarvar achieves moksha. It's not an irreversible process, obviously. If you give me one more minute, I just want to say, you know, there's a number of principles I think that are relevant here, so I'll just quickly point them out without being able to explain them, but I'd be happy to answer questions if you want later. So what do we see in this form of scripturalization, textualization, and then now canonization. First of all, the text is fixed in the mind, but also in the Abhinaya. At the same time, it remains amenable to compression and expansion and also elaborate forms of emphasis and intensification. Secondly, sound itself, which is the primary medium in this text, sound exists in several overlapping modes. There's the inaudible mula, you know, the mula, the original text cannot be heard on principle. You cannot hear the mula. You have this inaudible mula hidden within the audible but pre-semanticized musical form of the text. And then after that, things kind of unfold in a rather degenerative fashion. You reach a point where you can actually hear everything. You have an audible semanticized text, which is also grammaticalized, although we also have transgrammatical utterance, and we have visual syllables because the poem is itself defined as a drishti kavya, a poem that has to be seen. Third, the performer is neither the poet nor a second author, as is in the case in what we call Purana recitation in South India, where the performer actually acts as a second author. This is not the case here, but he speaks for or as the author who is present in his icon, and he also sometimes speaks for or as the god. And more generally, you might say that the performer creates the universe within which this text exists and serves as a conduit for the true goal of the whole performance, namely anubhava, or enjoyment. Fourth, commentary is integral to the text. It is iyal, the most natural form of Tamil. Fifth, canonization depends upon the fixing of the text in Abhinaya, together with the accompanying rituals of enactment. And the text is literally incorporated in the Adayar performer. And sixth, I don't want to go into this, let me just say that there's a level of effectual and pragmatic performance, you could call it mantic. It has various aspects, but the text is not merely a kind of expressive element. It's a text which is meant to actually change something in the world and in the self-awareness of the audience and of the singer himself. You could say this is poetry as a kind of theurgy or condensed cosmology. So, you know, I could go on like this. This is the final sentence. I'm calling this mode, which I think is a rather distinctive South Indian mode of textuality, I'm calling it deep textuality for the reasons which I hope you can see by now. This deep textuality has a kind of cosmopolitan modality built into it. This is again following upon Shelley's work. And cosmopolitan in the sense that minimally that Namarvar's text, as it's performed in this way, becomes a kind of boundary marker for Tamil itself, with the regional but also with the trans-regional resonance. I'd better stop here. Thank you.